for hour two.
Welcome, Red Ice members. We are talking with Tim Ball, a very important program on ClimateGate. And by the way, I also want to mention that Tim was in the really interesting documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle, I think it was called, aired about 2 years ago, a year or two ago, which is from another great documentary that you can go and check out in terms of some of the facts, some of the science here. And a little bit later here, Tim, in the program, I want to get into the basically how you've been treated. I know that you've been vehemently attacked for your views and so forth, and maybe we can get into that a little bit later as well. But there's one thing that I stumble over yesterday. I think the article's been released on the 29th here today, and from the Times Online, they basically write that climate change data have been dumped. They say that scientists at the University of East Anglia have admitted throwing away much of the raw temperature data on which their predictions of global warming are based. It means that other academics are not able to check basic calculations said to have shown a long-term rise in temperature over the last 150 years. Have you heard about this, Tim?
Yes, and I knew that was going on, and this is where the tentacles of this thing are going to reach far and wide, because what happened was the Hadley Center, which is part of the United Kingdom Meteorological Office, UKMO, they were working together, and they were producing what's called HADCRUT, H-A-D-C-R-U-T, which is the Hadley and CRU temperature, and it is the global annual average temperature, which is put out to show the world that the global temperature is rising. And when McIntyre and others started through Freedom of Information seeking this data, of course, Jones blocked it, and in fact, there are emails with Wigley saying to Jones, I hope that they don't find out that there's a Freedom of Information Act in the UK. And Jones coming back saying, well, if they do, I'll deny the information to them, and if necessary, I'll delete the files. And, of course, now whether he did that or not is debatable, because he's lied twice about it in emails. But if he did do it, then that is a criminal act under the law, whistleblower law, disclosure freedom of information law in Britain.
Yes.
And what happened was that as McIntyre and others pushed for this information, they started stonewalling, first by Jones, and then using the public relations officer at the University of East Anglia. And and then they eventually involved the public relations at the United Kingdom Met Office. Now, the argument that was made was that the raw data was collected by, paid for by taxpayer money and was available to everybody. However, because that data had been adjusted, the adjustment then made it proprietary, and that is that it couldn't be released, and that the information that the UK Met Office got from other countries fell into that category, and they used that as a smokescreen to deny the information to McIntyre and others. As they pushed, it finally, the United Kingdom Met Office, first of all, Hadley and CRU separated about a year ago. Now, clearly somebody at Hadley was saying, you know, we're getting ourselves in a lot of trouble here. And so that they separated, but the data set continued to be put out as HADCRUT. And then it was suddenly announced that the raw data was lost. And this was the United Kingdom Met Office. Now, of course, what people don't realize is that the raw data is never published in the public forum. It's always data that has been, quote-unquote, corrected.
Yeah.
And it's corrected for a variety of reasons. And so the original raw data now is gone. And you know, that in itself involves criminality, and of course, who's going to be held responsible for that, and how is a really very interesting question.
It is.
But that's the background behind that story.
But so, what does it mean? Basically, do we have to go back and do it all over again? And if we do, maybe we can do it properly this time. Or what does this mean? What would this lead to?
Well, well, one of the difficulties in climate research and reconstruction, and it's something I confronted all my career, is that you've got three different periods of climate research when you're trying to reconstruct temperatures. The first is the modern instrumental record, which is generally referred to scientifically as the secular record. And then you've got the historic record, which are diaries and journals and dates of occurrence of things, which is part of what I worked on and what Lam was working on. I also work with the instrumental record. And then you've got the long-term record, the tree rings, the sediments as were done in Sweden with the ice core varves and so on. You know, that's the sediment layers from glacial lakes and so on. And then you try to overlap all of these and recreate a temperature record. The difficulty is, of course, the accuracy as you go back in time diminishes. And what's amusing is in the modern record, we only measure to half a degree, yet they talk about, you know, 0.24 decimal points. But that modern instrumental record, once you've erased the raw data, you can't recover it. You can't reconstruct it. The only hope is that for some bizarre reason, somebody decided to make a file on it, and it's sitting on somebody's computer somewhere. Now, that could happen. But the chances are pretty slim. And
this is what it hinges on. Sorry to cut you off, Tim, but again, just to emphasize this point, that this is what it hinges on. Billions and billions are being spent on climate change and how to combat this and so forth. But this is, in one way, how weak the evidence is, and now even that is lost. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it is absolutely incredible. And of course, you see, the other incredible thing is that they put out papers, Jones and Mann and all these paper people put out papers using this data, but refused to tell you how they adjusted the raw data.
Yeah.
Now, to give you an example that just came out, New Zealand as a country is on the verge of passing cap and trade laws, restrictions of carbon and so on, and they've discovered that the five stations that are used to produce the average temperatures for New Zealand have all been doctored. What they've done is that they lowered the older temperatures, and in the case of, say, the Auckland airport, by 2 degrees Celsius, which is huge. And of course, what that does then is it changes the slope of temperature increase, making the current seem warmer than it is.
Uh-huh.
Now, this has been done with the CRU doing it. The other person that's been doing it is James Hansen, who is the director of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies at NASA.
Yes.
And of course, McIntyre caught him. Saying, well, 1998 was the warmest year on record in the U.S. when it turned out it was 1934. And Hansen just says, we made a mistake. No, sorry, you didn't. Every single change you made accentuated the warming.
Yeah.
And so this doctoring of data, you can't find out how they did the doctoring. You don't even know which stations that they chose. Because you see, there are about 1,200 stations of the World Meteorological Organization recognized as valid records, but they don't use all of those. They've chosen ones that particularly emphasize what's called the urban heat island effect. That is, they've been distorted because they're too close to cities. And so it's an incredibly complex thing, and the doctoring that they've done is so extensive that it's really frightening.
Absolutely. And what if we talk a little bit about the road to Copenhagen here now? We have this upcoming conference here in December again, and what is the outcome of that, do you see? I mean, there's talk of global CO2 taxes. Herman Van Rompuy, the newly elected, or selected rather, president of the European Union, said that he want to run the whole of EU on CO2 taxes pretty much as a way to beef up the European Union. But where do you see things are going in terms of the Copenhagen Agreement, if that indeed gets through, or if they in some way manage to come to a sort of agreement? Where do you see things are heading here, Tim?
Okay, you mentioned in your introduction to the first segment that this is the COP15, and COP stands for Conference of the Parties, and of course they've been having regular meetings to beef up the whole argument and to push the political and economic side of this issue. Copenhagen, of course, is critical because they need to replace Kyoto, and Kyoto came out of that 1992 conference in Rio that Strong organized, and of course became Kyoto because that was the city in Japan where that first meeting was held. And Kyoto was all about, it goes back to the Club of Rome, one world government, and we've got to punish these industrialized nations by taking some of the wealth they've accumulated and give it to the undeveloped nations in a form of global socialism, and that was part of the objective, of course, of the whole Kyoto thing. Ironically, in order to do that, they had to divide the nations of the world into the developed and the undeveloped nations, and the developed were in what was called Annex One. And the interesting thing about Kyoto is that although all the countries, or virtually all the countries in the world, were involved in it, only a few of them, the Annex I countries, were required to reduce their production of CO2, and also then were required to tax their people in order to pay these developing nations. So the Kyoto Accord, and by the way, what's interesting is another sidelight of this, and it just shows the extent to which this goes. Kyoto almost didn't succeed. They needed one more country to ratify it based on their own rules for it to become viable.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the holdout country was Russia. And Putin, who was was in charge, well, I'm not going to say in charge at the time, he's still effectively in charge.
Right.
but Putin was going to was not going to sign. And I heard a talk by his economic advisor at the time, Ilarionov, in Vancouver. And Ilarionov, who was Putin's chief economic advisor, said, "We're not going to sign." It was a choice between getting $2 billion in equalization payments or transfer payments through Kyoto, or growing the economy. And they realized they could make far more money by growing the economy and the $2 billion that they would get from equalization payments and all of the restrictions that would put on their economy.
Hmm.
Ilarionov went back to Russia, and within a couple of months, Putin had come out and said, "We're going to sign Kyoto." And he bluntly said, "The only reason I'm signing is because many of the European nations and others have told me if I don't sign, they will not support Russia's application to the World Trade Organization."
Hmm.
In other words, it was out now blackmail.
Extortion, yeah.
And of course, once Russia signed on, then they had sufficient to implement Kyoto. Now, of course, what's happened since is that they found out that so many nations, like Japan, for example, ratified but didn't implement.
Hmm.
So in other words, they played I'm green, I'm doing it, but actually did nothing. The ones that tried to implement it, like Spain and so on, and got into the green jobs thing, I mean, it's been devastating.
Yeah.
And so Kyoto was very, very quickly a failure. And then they've got the problem that and of course the Americans didn't sign,
right?
And I'll get to that in a minute. But now they've got the program that Kyoto, if it isn't put into force by 2012, it dies. It comes to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And I jokingly said, you've probably heard, and your listeners will have heard about this thing about, you know, the world coming to an end because of the Mayan calendar in 2012.
Right.
And yeah, right. You've heard about that. Well, I think the only thing that's going to be earth-shattering in 2012 is the death of Kyoto, but that's another issue.
Yeah.
The Kyoto Accord. One of the critical things that happened was the Americans weren't going to sign on, even though Al Gore was the vice president. When they took it to the U.S. Senate for approval, the U.S. Senate voted 95-0 against adopting Kyoto.
Hmm.
I mean, it wasn't even 95-0 is incredible. And there's 100 votes. The five that weren't there were sick or absent that day. So it was incredible.
Yeah.
Now, the Europeans, of course, and the others that were supporting it, particularly a lot of the European nations, UK very active in it, were, and through the CRU and Sir John Houghton and Bert Bolan, these people, were pushing the U.S. government. And so they went to the U.S. and said, well, look, what can we do to entice you to join? The U.S. government said, why don't we get some credits for the good things we're doing with CO2? That is, we're growing crops and we're planting trees, and that removes the CO2 that we're taking out of the atmosphere. Mm. In a most incredible response, they came back and said, well, we can't do that because we don't have any measures on how much CO2 is going in and out of the forests or going in and out of the crops.
Mm.
And yet here they were quite prepared to say, well, CO2 is the problem, we've got to stop it. That became then the carbon credits idea. Gore saw an opportunity here, okay, that in terms of Kyoto, it effectively died. It had been used as an enticement, it failed. But Gore saw an opportunity. And there was a meeting in the White House in 1998. And the four people present were Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Lord Brown of British Petroleum, and Ken Lay, who at the time was president of Enron. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the listeners will know the great scandal of Enron, the corruption in that. Enron was going to be the company in the U.S. that was going to make a fortune out of carbon credits and make a fortune for Al Gore. Enron, of course, were able to start their plans in California, which is why California now is in such severe energy problems and financial problems.
Hmm.
That was what crippled them.
Hmm.
And, of course, Gore then saw this opportunity, and then he worked with Morris Strong. And Morris Strong, by the way, is on the board of the Chicago Carbon Credit Exchange. Gore set up a company called General Investments Management, where they weren't specifically selling carbon credits, but were the broker for carbon credits. And in last year, I believe it is, he made $51 million. And in fact, he's probably going to be, well, not now, maybe, but he was on his way to being the first green billionaire. But that carbon credits idea, that's how it carried on, essentially outside of Kyoto and IPCC. It now had a marketable quality to it. And of course, that gave it life and kept it going because people saw business opportunities. And it then started to realize, politicians started to realize, and I keep saying, I wish politicians were as good at running governments as they are at dreaming up ways of getting taxes. And of course, they saw this as a very environmentally friendly way of extracting taxes from people.
Yes.
But of course, the minute that it was called a carbon tax, people started to say, oh, no, we don't want any of that stuff. And so they changed the name. And this is one of the things that you can watch, and I've watched throughout this and try to draw people's attention to. When they move the goalposts by changing the name, they're up to something.
Yeah.
And so suddenly carbon credits and carbon tax became cap and trade.
Yes.
And of course that was beautiful because capping, oh, that nasty pollution, we're going to cap that. trade. Oh, this is going to be profitable, and it'll not harm the economy in any way, and so that's how that name came into play. The blunt fact is, it's a cap and tax, pure and simple. And by the way, one of the things, of course, that's interesting, and Wigley even acknowledges this in one of the emails. He said that, you know, Kyoto is really essentially useless. We're going to have to do a lot more beyond Kyoto to shut down the CO2 and the industry. But here's the point: even if all the countries that were agreed to ratify and were required to participate in Kyoto reach their target, and you took everybody off the planet and left one woman behind, a scientist, to measure the change in CO2, they would not be able to detect the change in CO2 because of the humans being gone.
Huh.
That's how small the human contribution is.
Yeah.
But of course, as David Suzuki, the Canadian extreme environmentalist, said, oh no, Kyoto's just the start. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back to your original point about Copenhagen, of course, if Kyoto's just the start, then they have to perpetuate it at Copenhagen.
Yes.
And, of course, now, the other thing that happened, and again, I knew what was going on because I had watched it with the CFCs and the ozone issue. The parallels between that and CO2 as a pollutant and so on are really quite incredible. The scale is very different, of course. But what happened was they identified CFC as destroying the ozone. There was never a single shred of scientific evidence to support that claim. And as I said before a parliamentary committee in Canada on this issue, I said, but ozone is created by sunlight. And you're assuming, as the IPCC does, that that sunlight is effectively constant.
Huh.
Therefore, you've eliminated the major possible cause of the change. You're forced, therefore, to look for another cause.
Yeah.
And of course, what they always look for is a human cause.
Mm.
And so here, CFCs got fingered. And by the way, another Nobel Prize with Melina and I forgot the other guy's name in this issue. But what happened was with the ozone, they set up what was called the Montreal Protocol. And at that protocol meeting, they said, well, look, we've got to reduce CFCs, and we're going to reduce ours, and everybody's got to do it. India and China said, hey, hang on a minute. You've used refrigeration to reduce your food losses by 30%. That's huge in terms of feeding the world. And now you're telling us that we can't use it?
Yeah.
They came back and said, hey, what we'll do is you reduce yours, we'll raise ours to your level, and we'll accept the deal. Well, the world said no. So India and China did not sign the Montreal Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Well, precisely the same thing is happening with the Kyoto, because India and China not only didn't have to sign as part of the Annex II group, the developing nations group, mm-hmm. But now where they're being pressured, they're saying, hey, get lost. We want to grow our economy. And what's interesting to me is that India trumped the moral issue, because the environmental groups have been able to say, oh, well, we're environmentalists. We care about the world. The rest of you don't care. You're evil people. Well, India came along and said, hey, you're telling us the world's going to warm up by 1 degree in 100 years? What's the big deal? You're telling us it's warmed up by that in the last 100 years, and the world hasn't come to an end. In fact, the world's improved.
Mm.
And oh, by the way, we've got more pressing issues. We've got people starving to death.
Yeah,
exactly. So they trumped that whole moral high ground that these people have used and taken.
Mm.
And so because of in India and China, and of course, as we know, China's building 2 coal power plants a week. They've got 50 nuclear power plants in construction. And ironically, and this just shows how quickly things have turned around, India, the amount that you are required to pay under Kyoto is determined as a percentage of your GDP.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
China is now the fourth highest GDP in the world, but they don't have to pay anything. In fact, they get money. from the other nations, even from nations that have lower GDPs than they do.
Oh, God.
India is 13th on the list of GDPs, and they don't have to pay anything either, and they get money in this Kyoto nonsense. So, of course, this is how it's kind of come around full circle. And so what will happen at Copenhagen is that they will do just a little Canadian story, if I can indulge for a minute.
Yes.
But there was a big conference in a place called Charlottetown in Canada to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Confederation, the forming of Canada as a country. Mm. And all the then current premiers met. And, of course, they all came out of the meeting with the media there, and each of them, as they came out, wonderful meeting, very informative, very valuable. And then one of them, Joey Smallwood from the wonderful province of Newfoundland, marvelous people, who, by the way, have suffered, and we could talk about that. But anyway, he came out and said, "We met, and we agreed to meet again."
Mm.
And he said, "Bingo, that's the truth." Mm. A politician telling the truth. That's what will happen at Copenhagen. That's precisely what will happen at Copenhagen. But it'll sound all very good because of the bureaucratic language and the spinning. And of course, that's what's doing us in, these spin doctors. What we almost need is a school that trains people in how to decode and translate spin.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you mentioned here before then that the Kyoto basically dies in 2012. Well, kind of dovetailing with this is that the leaders of the Commonwealth countries met now this Saturday and called basically for a legal binding international agreement. You can read in Global Government there if you want to, because this is about climate change and basically a global fund with billions of dollars to help poorer countries meet its mandates. And it said here as well that the 53 nation meeting was the largest gathering of world leaders before next month global climate change in Copenhagen. The leaders said a deal should be adopted no later than next year, and the support money should be available simultaneously, providing up to $10 billion a year starting in 2012. So the idea here then is that this should dovetail where Kyoto dies, so to speak. Copenhagen should take the torch, so to speak, right?
Yes. Well, of course, what they're pointing out there, and the truth of it is, and cutting through all of that spin, as you said, it's partly the equalization that we're taking from the rich and giving to the poor. But of course, it isn't doing that. If you debilitate the rich, that is, you degrade their ability to be rich, then they haven't got any foreign aid or money to help the poor. So you actually drag both sides down.
Hmm.
And that's the first lie in this. The second is, of course, I think George Bernard Shaw, the English playwright, said that if you rob Peter to pay Paul, you're always going to get Paul's vote.
Hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And of course, that's what's going on here. You see it with the countries like the Maldives, the islands, and they did that ludicrous thing where they held a meeting underwater in scuba outfits. And, of course, they're using the argument that, oh, we're going to drown and you've got to pay us and so on, when Niels Axel Mårner, the world expert on sea levels, said, it's absolute nonsense. The sea level hasn't changed in 30 years. In fact, if anything, it's risen, or the islands have risen. Mm. And the sea level one, of course, is the one that they use all the time because it's one that frightens people, particularly in the low areas like the Netherlands and so on, and the Ganges deltas and so on. But no, I mean, all of these people that stand to get money out of this or make money out of it. So you're going to see a lot of the corporations that are receiving benefits. I spoke to five farm communities in Alberta, Canada, about a week ago, and at one of the meetings there was a fellow from a carbon company selling carbon credits to farmers, and you know, I mean, and he was very honest with it because I spoke with him. He said, "I don't care about the science. I don't care what the argument is. I see a business opportunity. I'm going to pursue it." And of course, that's in a sense, I prefer business that is honest like that. The businesses I don't like are the hypocritical ones that are saying, "Oh, I'm selling organic bananas because I care about the environment." No, you don't. You care about the fact you can charge four times more for it. And if you're losing money on it, you wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
Stop the hypocrisy.
Right.
Okay. But these people are going to fight like the Dickens to keep all of that potential business opportunities going. So the government funding and the lies from CRU have combined to create a whole huge industry out there. Bureaucracies have grown, and they will do everything they can to perpetuate this thing, and that's going to be the most difficult challenge. And of course, that's why getting out there, the degree to which these people have cooked the books, and that being the basis of everything, that is why it's so critical. Now, whether the public will be willing to pay the price, I don't know. I know when I talk, back up a bit. Environmentalism is a new paradigm, a new view of the world, absolutely essential. Still some changes need to be done.
Yeah.
But when new paradigms come in, most people don't know how far to go with it. They tend to be fearful of change because they know it could hurt them. But they don't know. And I'll give you a good example that everybody can relate to immediately. Feminism. Absolutely necessary. Absolutely, still some changes need to be made. And to their credit, some of the Scandinavian countries were the first to realize this. But the majority of women were saying, well, how far do we go with this? And then the extremists start doing silly things. And then, so what that does then is define the limits for the majority. And this is how I've learned to understand the role of extremists in a society. They set the limits for the majority. So with the environmental movement, you know, people are saying, yeah, well, we need the environment, but how far do we go with it? Well, now it's going to cost me my job. Well, I'm not quite so sure anymore.
Yeah.
And when I talk to high schools, a regular thing that I do with them, I say, you guys care about the environment. Yeah, yeah, rah, rah, rah. Then I say, okay, none of you will ever drive cars. And I get that look on their faces. Well, I don't care that much.
What a bummer, yeah.
In other words, what I've done by taking an extreme position is make them think about the limits of this idea and how far they're willing to take it. And I think the world's at that level now, and I think that the people that are planning Kyoto understand that, and they realize that they've got to push it through now, or they won't get it through. And you see that with the polls gradually shifting, that 71% of the Times of London saying that, you know, that they didn't think that humans were causing global warming. And so this is all tied up with how the thing has evolved politically. But Copenhagen really is a last chance. And it's why, by the way, that Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, who desperately needs to appear green because he's in really deep trouble politically, is leaping on it. And he said, oh, we've got 50 days left. You know, and it's that sort of doomsday scenario with a specific date on it. And Prince Charles coming out and saying, well, we've got 100 months left.
Yeah.
And we have David Suzuki. But I tease him because, you know, he said there's 10 years left. The problem is he said it 20 years ago. And so this is why they want to put the pressure on and say, look, this is the last chance. And by the way, Gore, in his latest book, How to, you know, Solutions to the Climate Crisis, I mean, he actually quotes Deuteronomy, the Bible, and what a wonderful thing to be able to quote the Bible. I'm just looking for the quote here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can't put my fingers on it. But anyway, he quotes the Bible saying, Deuteronomy says, you know, this is your last chance.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Apocalyptic thinking right there, you know.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And of course, it's the guilt thing, too. You know, if you don't do it, it's your fault.
Right, of course. Well, that's another thing, and that ties in with the spin that you mentioned before, that they are very prone to put this on an emotional level. They show a polar bear on a sinking little piece of ice, and they, you know, they put it on the emotional level. And again, what we're seeing now with these emails that has been put out on the web and so forth is that the data is faulty and it's being skewed, and that's so it doesn't hold up, it doesn't make sense, and also the consensus is the image that they put out is that all scientists worldwide agree, everyone agrees, you know, there's no scientist in the world out there who disagree. But I mean, I stumbled over a video recently that claimed that Al Gore actually is being sued by over 30,000 scientists for global warming fraud. Have you heard about that, Tim?
Yes, well, of course, the guy that started that was John Coleman, the founder of the Weather Channel in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And Coleman, the basic argument is this, that Gore, as identified CO2 as a pollutant and a threat to the world and needs to be reduced, and the way that we can do it is if we buy carbon credits. Mm-hmm. And he then turned around and profited from that. Well, in the U.S., if you create the problem and then profit from it, that is fraud.
Mm.
And that's the basis of this argument that these people are using against Gore. Now, whether that'll come to fruition or not is very interesting, because one thing Gore's been able to do is, even when he has appeared before the U.S. Senate, he's broken all of their rules with their approval. I mean, for example, I appeared before the U.S. Senate, and I was told if I did not have all of my paper, all of the details, and all of the multiple copies in by a specific minute, that I would not be allowed to appear. Gore walks in there, and 5 minutes before he gives his paper, he hands it out.
Hmm.
In other words, he not only broke every rule they had, they allowed him to do it.
Yeah.
And so this is of course part of the cynicism of politicians. It really is disturbing. I've lost the theme of what you mentioned there.
I want to ask you, we can change angle here a little
sorry,
bit.
Sorry to jump back in again.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, and just let me use one example.
Right.
First of all, the consensus thing, that was it. Consensus is not a scientific fact.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
As Einstein said, you know, you can have hundreds of things proving it, you've only got to find one thing that disproves it.
That's
it's gone.
Correct. That's
done.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, that's the consensus issue. Consensus is a very important thing in politics. And when they started using that argument, it was a sign to me of how political this issue had become. Okay? And people have asked me to sign petitions, and I've signed some of them with the proviso of saying, look, just because you can say, well, there's a consensus disagrees, that doesn't make it right either.
Hmm.
In science.
Yeah.
It does in politics, okay? So that's the first thing. The second thing you mentioned, and I think this does need elaboration, is the Arctic ice and the polar bear issue.
Yeah.
And the emotionalism. I flew search and rescue in the Canadian Arctic for 5 years. I know the Arctic extremely well. I've been into every airport throughout the Canadian Arctic and in Alaska, and some of them in Greenland and Iceland. And so I'm very, very familiar with the Arctic. And we used to do ice patrols up the east coast of North America, right up into Baffin Island and so on. So I'm very, very knowledgeable about that. And one of the things that's interesting is this is how education has distorted people's image of the mind, of the world, I should say. When you sit in school, because the globe is spherical, and you have to show it, and it's always been a problem, as you know, the mapping. You've got to take a three-dimensional object and put it in a two-dimensional form.
Yeah.
The minute you do that, and there's been all sorts of attempts to, geoidal forms and, you know, different projections and so on. But the classic one, of course, is the Mercator projection. It was developed for navigation, so a straight line is a great circle on the map. But what it did was it meant that the only accurate part of the map was the equator.
Hmm.
And as you moved away from the equator, it became increasingly distorted to the point where suddenly the North Pole, which is a single point, became the same length as the equator. Okay. Then it also meant then that nobody had any idea of the shape and size of the Arctic Ocean. All right.
Oh.
And now when you, and I do this with audiences, I'll show them a map of the Arctic ice looking down on the North Pole. And they have to look at it for quite a while. And then when I start pointing out different features that they recognize, oh, now I see. So they have no idea that every single year, 16 million square kilometers of ice forms in the Arctic, and every single summer, anywhere from 9 to 10 million square kilometers of that ice melts. And that ice melts in approximately 145 days, which is at the rate of, I'm going to get my numbers right here, but it's at a tremendous rate. it's something like 66,000 square kilometers a day.
Jeez.
Okay, that's normal.
Yeah,
it's incredible. And so, you know, in other words, you and I could put out an article tomorrow and say, you know, or not, couldn't do it now because the ice is reforming. But we could put out an article in July and say, you know, 66,000 square kilometers of ice melted yesterday in the Arctic.
Yeah.
It's a catastrophe.
Yeah.
But it would be fact. And one of the things these people then are doing is they're taking normal events and telling you they're abnormal.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, of course, means that they can never be wrong because tomorrow there's going to be more normal events. Okay? And the Arctic ice is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
And here's an example of how they played the game. First of all, we've only got satellite measure of Arctic ice since 1978. And I questioned the first 2 years of that because it took them time to calibrate the satellite sign. So really the record's only good from 1980 on. And you see this summer-winter variability. And of course, they immediately lapped onto it because, yes, there was warming up to 2000. So, of course, the amount of summer ice was less in that period from 1980 on.
Mm.
So they lapped on that. And, of course, you heard Prince Charles come out and say, well, there'll be no summer ice in 10 years. Well, this summer, the summer ice didn't, you know, was back to the long-term average, let's say long-term, that period of record. And but here's the way they play the game. In 2005, an area of ice melted more than the previous year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the story that came out was, oh, an area of ice the size of the state of Texas melted more this year than last year.
Mm.
Now, the terminology, and we get into the spin doctoring thing that I talked about, in people's minds, the state of Texas is huge.
Yeah.
Okay? The fact is, it's only half the size of one of the Canadian provinces, the province of Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's mm-hmm. the first thing. And of course, but Texans want you to believe it's big. And there's that wonderful joke, and your audience would appreciate this, about the New England farmer talking to the Texas farmer, and he says, how big is your ranch? And the Texan thinks for a minute, and he said, it takes me 2 days to drive around my ranch in my pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
And the New England farmer thinks for a minute and says, yeah, I've got a pickup truck like that too.
That's what you mean.
Okay, but you see the use of the term. Now, when you take the size of the state of Texas in area and then put it against the 10 million square kilometers that have melted, it's about 4%.
Mm.
In other words, it's within the variability of natural summer melting.
Mm.
But that's not the impression that's created by the way they presented it. And so it is a perfect example. And then to reinforce the point, as you said, well, if you don't think the melting ice is a problem, think about those poor polar bears.
Right, right.
Well, let me tell you a couple of things about polar bears. And Willie Soon from Harvard and I published an article on the polar bears. And as I said, I've watched them. I've worked with Mitchell, who is the world expert on polar bears and lives in the Arctic, has for 30 years, at Mitchell Taylor, I should say. And he said, look, the polar bears are not in decline. In fact, the Eskimos, and we call them Inuit here in Canada, are telling us they've never seen so many polar bears.
Really?
But the polar bear is only recently evolved from the Alaska brown bear, about 100,000 years ago, which in evolutionary time is yesterday.
Yeah.
They live and forage very comfortably off the land, so they could go back to the land quite easily. They prefer the seal, so it's like you and I, you know, we go to a restaurant, we could eat all the things on the menu, but there's certain things we prefer.
Mm.
And if we have a choice, we're going to take it. Well, that's true of the polar bear.
Mm.
But here's the other thing. And I was working at Churchill on Hudson Bay, and there was a colleague there who was working on polar bears. And he wanted to determine the efficiency of the polar bear in retaining body heat. And, of course, this is very interesting in climate science and micrometeorology and so on. And he took infrared photographs of the polar bear. That is, photographs that sensed the amount of heat that the polar bear was getting off. they didn't show up on the infrared photographs. Their ability to retain their body heat with their fur is that efficient.
Wow.
And you say, well, if the fur is that thick and dense, surely if it gets wet, they're going to sink. But they have a second fur. It's a long fur. It's a hollow fur. And it tends to be yellowy in color, but it's actually translucent. That is, the light goes through it. The sunlight goes into it. It is then transmitted inside, bounces down into the body to heat the body. But because that fur is long and hollow, it floats. And I want your audience, the next time you see pictures of polar bears floating, especially from above, you'll see all of this fur floating up around them. Almost like a halo around them. And, of course, all they've got to do then is paddle as if they were walking on land. I have seen polar bears up to 150 kilometers offshore. And so this argument about the polar bears is purely an emotional one.
Yes.
And you notice, by the way, this extends through the arguments about extinction. They only pick animals that have anthropomorphic, that is, human-like qualities. When I talked to audiences, I said, look, so, you know, the World Wildlife Fund with the panda and dolphins with the big eyes, it's always the big eyes, the seals and all of this stuff. And when I talk to audiences, I say, look, you know, there are a lot of animals that have grown in population because of the ecological opportunities the humans have provided. I said, you know, pigeons are proliferating. Rats are increasing in number. Snakes, tremendously. Coyotes. And then I pause and I say, have I mentioned any you like yet?
Okay. Good point. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, and of course, this is, as I said, it's all part of the skillful manipulation of the emotion that you were talking about.
Yes, absolutely. Very good point with the that we identify because we anthropomorphize everything we look at. So we see the human traits or whatever, and we identify with that. And again, these people know how to do that. Tim,
oh, yes.
I want to talk just a little bit briefly here before we round things up here for the second hour, is that basically where things are heading now in terms of the climate. I want you to comment on water vapor, what importance this has basically in reading global temperatures and how it affects that and so forth, and also the idea, are we heading for global cooling now? Is the globe actually cooling down? And if so, what is the outcome of that? Will it just go up and down in these little cycles as it always does, or will it go in one area to the extreme? What do you know about that, Tim?
Okay, just a very quick climate lesson, I guess. And of course, as we talked earlier about how they focused on CO2, which is not the largest greenhouse gas, they virtually ignore water vapor because water vapor is the one gas in the atmosphere that varies very widely naturally. So you can go to the polar regions and it's almost a 0% of the atmosphere. But you can go to the tropics where it's 4% of the gases in the atmosphere. And because of that, our ability to measure accurately the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. And by the way, that's also the reason why they're unable to cope with clouds in their computer models. And of course, that's one of the great scandals of this thing, that here you got computer models doing forecasting for the world temperature and future when they can't even put the clouds in properly. But it's because of the water vapor. Now, there are many other things that they've left out, but if I can answer your question this way, the major control mechanisms of long-term climate variability, first of all, on the scale of the ice ages, and of course, Scandinavia, Western Europe, under a massive ice sheet just 20,000 years ago, and you're now rebounding from that, and of course the Baltic getting smaller and all of those sorts of things as the land rises. The long-term scale and those ice ages are apparently related to the orbit of the Sun around the Milky Way galaxy. Now, this theory was postulated, and I remember teaching about it 25 years ago or more, because as a climatologist, you have to read what the solar physicists are saying and astronomers are saying. So every 250 million years, we go into an ice age. Within that ice age, there are glacials and interglacials. Between the ice ages, there is about 250 million years. That seems to correlate with the passage of the sun through arms of galactic dust in the Milky Way.
Yeah.
Now that's the long term. On a shorter scale, and this is completely left out of the computer models of the IPCC, is what is called the Milankovitch effect. Now, 150 years ago, a Scottish scientist and shopkeeper by the name of James Croll was calculating how changes in the orbit of the Earth around the sun would affect the global temperature by the amount of energy we receive from the sun. We're still teaching many of our students that the orbit of the Earth around the sun is a fixed elliptical orbit. It isn't. It's almost circular now, and 20,000 years ago it was much more extreme ellipse. It's caused by the gravitational pull of the planet Jupiter, and the orbit of the sun goes from almost circular to extreme ellipse and back again in a cycle of 100,000 years. That 100,000 year cycle is seen in the buildup of glaciers, as I say, the one that occurred 20,000 years ago, and then the collapse of those glaciers. It's the main controlling factor in that. There are shorter changes in the sun, the physical sun-Earth relationship, the change of tilt. So each year the tilt of the Earth is different, and of course that then changes something people in Scandinavia are very familiar with, the actual line of the Arctic Circle and that area of the Earth that is in 24 hours of night and day. That's changing every single year, as is the orbit of the Earth. None of that is in their computer models, okay? These are the main long-term major controlling mechanisms. There's another one called precession of the equinox, the day on which we have equal day and night.
Yes.
And that, by the way, because our calendars are fixed and nature's changing, is why we have to keep changing our calendars.
That's right, exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
Right? Now, that's the major controls. Now, so what we've got is variation in the amount of energy coming from the sun because of physical relationships between the sun and the Earth. Then there's the sun itself, and the sun puts out energy in two basic forms. One is the electromagnetic, which is the heat and light, and that is the only one that the IPCC include. And in the most bizarre statement, they say, oh, well, it was the major control of global temperature up until about 20 years ago. It explained up to 60% of the temperature in their models.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it became 90% CO2 that was causing it.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I mean, this is the most incredibly... In fact, I've got to tell you, if a first-year university student or even a graduate student, I give them an F instantly. Okay? But here these people are getting away with this. But one of the problems that we have is that... So they're saying, oh, well, the energy from the sun, and it's called insolation, incoming solar radiation, it only varies in our records by about 0.14%, so it's insignificant. But here's the key. You can change that energy by 6% in a theoretical way. That will account for all of the temperature change that we know occurred in the history of the Earth. So in other words, they're saying, well, it's 0.14%, so people say, oh, well, that's of 100%. Well, that's minuscule.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's really 0.14% of 6%, and it's huge, okay?
Yeah.
The second thing is that the sun, we've known for, there's very early observations of this, from Galileo's first observations of sunspots in 1610, and it's not long after that that people are starting to say, you know, there's a correlation here, that when there's a high sunspot, the Earth is warmer. When there's low sunspots, the Earth is cooler.
Yeah.
And so we've known about this very high correlation. The IPCC have rejected that on the grounds, and unfortunately legitimate grounds, that just because there's a high correlation, you cannot assume cause and effect. Okay? And I used to warn my students about this all the time. And one of my favorite stories was that Diet Coke causes obesity because there's a very, very high correlation between the number of obese people that drink a Diet Coke. Okay?
Yeah.
And so they said, well, just because the number of sunspots is varying and the temperature is varying, you don't know what the mechanism, therefore we're going to ignore it.
Oh.
Well, okay, now, here's the interest. This is, again, where Jones fiddled the books in collusion with Wigley, because a very, very viable mechanism came out by Svensmark and Christensen, and where they showed that the sunspots were simply a manifestation of changes in the sun, and they correlated with changes in the magnetic strength of the sun.
Yes.
And the strength of the magnetic sun, okay, the strength of the magnetic sun acted like a filter for the amount of cosmic radiation reaching the Earth. Okay, now one of the things that we've grappled with in climatology for a long time is that in order for water to condense from a gas water vapor into a liquid, you need what's called a condensation nuclei, a little particle. And, of course, that's why when you seed the clouds, you increase the rate of condensation and therefore increase the potential rate of cloud,
yes.
of rain.
Yes.
Okay, we couldn't figure out, there was not enough particles for the amount of cloud that we had.
Hmm.
Well, we now know that when those cosmic radiations pass through the atmosphere, they're physically changed into particles that become condensation nuclei. And what Svensmark and Christian showed was that there was a very, very high correlation between cosmic radiation and low cloud. So what's happening then is that as the sunspots appear, they determine how much low cloud there is. And then if you take that analogy into your greenhouse, how do you reduce the temperature in a greenhouse? Well, you pull the screen down.
Mm-hmm.
To block the sunlight coming in.
Yeah.
Well, that's precisely what this cosmic radiation is doing.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, Jones and Wigley agreed that they couldn't allow this stuff in there. Okay? Even now, there was now peer-reviewed literature on it, although they couldn't allow this in. So what they did was, and Jones talks about this, he says, you know, I'll change the date on which, and I'll change what's considered to be peer review if I have to. Okay?
Mm.
So they set dates, and they said, well, if your article isn't in by the in publication peer reviewed by this date, we can't consider it. Blindly ignoring the fact that Christensen and Larsen, and then later Svensmark, published their first paper in 1991.
Mm.
And that in fact Svensmark and their material had come out in 2004 before the 2007 report. So they skillfully changed the dates. And by the way, the other thing they did was they had an article that counteracted McIntyre and McKittrick. They submitted it for publication, but it hadn't been published when they had to get their IPCC report in, so they referred to it anyway.
Hmm.
And, of course, what happened was that after the report came out with this article listed, the journal rejected it. And, of course, that's why they moved to get rid of that editor. And so, as I said, the number of stories, the machinations, and what these people did. But to get back to the weather issue and the climate issue,
mm-hmm.
So we've got the sun then, and so neither the physical changes, orbit tilt and so on, are not in their models, and the sunspot date is not in their models either,
mm-hmm.
And in fact, they do talk about them reasonably, I would say a page or so in the 2001 report. They hardly get a single line in the 2007 report.
Oh my God.
Now, okay. Now, once that energy, the insulation energy, reaches the atmosphere, it passes through the atmosphere and reaches the surface. A lot of that energy is reflected back to space, and it's called the energy cycle, and by the way, it was a Russian climatologist, and I think there are some of the best in the world, Budyko, and I worked with some of them, Boris Enkov, and we can talk about a conference in Warsaw in 1990 where some of these issues came up.
Hmm.
But anyway, that whole energy balance that Budyko said, look, let's stop doing it on the basis of temperature measurements, let's do it on energy. energy in, energy out, and we can. And that's why you got into this watts per square meter and so on.
Oh.
Well, the IPCC produced an energy balance model, and again, it was somebody associated with CRU, Kevin Tranberth, that produced that that model that became the standard. Now, people all along have been saying, but it doesn't work that way. This radiation model you're using is simply wrong. But it became the gold standard in the IPCC, of course, and it was built in there.
Yeah.
Now, how that energy from the sun is affected as it passes through the atmosphere, reaches the surface of the Earth, warms the surface of the Earth, and then that heat is re-radiated back out to space, where it is affected by, slowed in its escape by the so-called greenhouse gases, is what they've really focused on.
Yeah.
And, of course, the greenhouse effect started as a simple analogy to explain to students how there was an imbalance in a short-term basis between the amount of energy coming in from the sun and the amount of heat escaping to space. And so they created this greenhouse model. In fact, the real greenhouse the gardeners use doesn't work like a greenhouse, or the atmosphere doesn't work like that at all, because the real greenhouse doesn't include convection, it doesn't include the water vapor transfer of energy, and all of these other things. So it's a terrible analogy. But it's become so much a part of our language,
yes,
that it's going to be hard to get rid of.
It's just incredible. And I'm glad, by the way, that you brought up Henrik Svensmark. I was going to ask you about him, and he wrote a book called The Shilling Stars, A Cosmic View of Climate Change,
yes,
which goes into detail in about basically how the effects of cosmic radiation has on cloud formation, and that actually it chills the planet pretty much, or cools it down.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Tim, I think that this is a good point and good note to begin to round things up for here on this time. We really enjoyed having you on and to clarify some of these issues for us. And we, and I guess you as well, are going to keep a keen eye on what the developments are now here in regards to the email, what is being discovered and so forth. But please, again, for us, mention a few of your websites so people know where to go to find out more information and maybe where they can follow along in the story as it progresses, Tim.
Okay, the two that I'm directly involved with friendsofscience.org, which is a group I helped set up of retired professional people who were absolutely angry at the bad science, but had the problem that they were from the province of Alberta, which of course is a huge energy province, so they were labeled with that. Friends of Science, where we try to explain the science as I've just done in ways people can understand with analogies and so on. And then where I do more of the linking of political and the science is CanadaFreePress.com, and people can access that. And then others that I've had input to, what's up with that, is a very, very good one. Anthony Watts, of course, a meteorologist himself, and of course his whole story about looking at how terrible the instruments and the weather stations are, how compromised they are, and then if you want to look at probably the most comprehensive site on CO2 itself, and something we haven't even talked here, is CO2 science. Is it .org? I believe it's .org.
I think it is, yes.
I can check that. But anyway, this is by Sherwood Itso and his son Craig Itso. Sherwood Itso is a world authority on CO2. And one thing we haven't mentioned here is that, of course, plants absolutely depend upon CO2 for their growth. And in fact, a lawyer and I filed a brief with the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. saying, look, if you're going to reduce CO2, we are going to get power of attorney for the plants and vote on their behalf to prevent that happening. So it's a bit sort of a tongue-in-cheek type of thing, but it illustrates the point.
Exactly.
Yet it is co2science.org. And the other ones, of course, those are good ones to start with.
Excellent. Again, friendsofscience.org, canadafreepress.com, co2science.org. Tim Ball, great to have you with us. Thank you for talking with us, and keep up the great work, okay?
Thank you, and I hope I've explained some things that even you were puzzled about. And if you have any questions and if you want me to come back on again, I'd be very happy to do it.
friends, we present